Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Joyce Carol Oates. Oates grew up in a hardscrabble working-class town in upstate New York. She has described her youth as a daily scramble for existence. She was given a typewriter at the age of 14 and since then has been writing novels, sometimes as many as two or three in a year. By 1969, at the age of just 31, she won the National Book Award for the novel Them. Since then, she has become one of the most prolific and celebrated novelists alive, one that has shown remarkable dexterity by writing in multiple genres. Her professional career is all the more remarkable for the dedication she has shown to teaching, primarily at Princeton, where she's been on faculty since 1978. She has had a hand in the careers of dozens of writers, including most recently Jonathan Safran Foer. Recent work includes her 26th book, We Were the Mulvaneys, published in 1996, which became an Oprah Winfrey Book Club selection. The novels The Falls, published in 2004, and The Gravedigger's Daughter, published in 2007, were both New York Times bestsellers. Here's Joyce Carol Oates in 1989 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here with such a gracious introduction. Well, this evening, I'm very honored to be here. This is such a fine series that we've heard a good deal about it in the East. It seems that many of my writer friends have been here, and the reports are always very, very laudatory. So I'm deeply honored to be here in this beautiful city, too. I have a project I've been working on for about a year. It's called The Life of the Writer and the Life of the Career. It's one of these very elastic works that must be about 50 pages now, but don't, you know, feel waves of terror because I don't intend to read 50 pages. I will move around in it. There are sections in it, and I'll talk and read in these various sections and see if I can get through to the end. I'm very much looking forward to a question and answer period because it gets somewhat lonely up here, especially with the lights shining in my face, so I can't actually tell all the time if there's any audience, you know. So if there's a question and answer period and people are actually asking questions, then it gives me confidence that there's someone, in fact, out there. So I'll be looking forward to that. I'll read and talk for 45 or 50 minutes, and then we'll have questions and answers. So you might want to formulate some. What I'm going to be talking about is quite theoretical, at least in outline, and I have specific examples. But I think of my work, my theoretical work, is very provisional. I don't think of myself as dogmatic or didactic. I don't feel I have final answers by any means. So some people may have ideas or comments that would be very helpful. All my life I've been fascinated by the mystery of human personality. Who are we? So diverse, and yet perhaps beneath diversity, so much akin. Why are we here, and where indeed is here? What does it mean to be alive on this earth? The mystery of human existence opens out into the mystery of all material and physical matter. And the fundamental question, which has always excited me, even before I knew how to formulate it, sort of an ancient philosophical question, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there being in a universe? And what does it mean to be a human being? When we begin as writers, specifically, it's out of a fascination, sometimes amounting to obsession, with language, with the mysterious power and sometimes just the sound of words. I mean, clearly all artists are drawn in the direction of special materials and special talents. But for the writer, it's language. Language is something that we work with, we sculpt. And the sounds can be haunting, even apart from their meanings, particularly for poets. As the years pass, if we persist in our devotion, we're led to places we've never been. We come into contact with worlds and with people foreign to us. In doing so, in turn, we become other people. We participate in that mysterious enlargement of sympathies of which D.H. Lawrence spoke, and that seems to be the highest ideal of any kind of art, is the enlargement of human sympathy. But what are the origins of this impulse and of the impulse to create art more generally? The poet William Stafford says, this is a small quote from a longer poem, "So the world happens twice. Once we see it as is. Second, it legends itself deep, the way it is." The crucial word here is legends, with its suggestion of storytelling, a secondary creation over and above the happening of the world in which we find ourselves. This seems to be very self-evident. We experience things in life. You may see an athletic event, let's say, and that the experience is one thing, but then there's a certain eagerness in talking about it and reading about it and seeing how it's written up, as if existential reality is not completely satisfying until it's been transmogrified somehow and filtered through someone's consciousness, put into language. It's almost as if you don't know what you have seen until you see what someone else has made of it, or you articulate it yourself in terms of language. This clearly sets us apart from any other species. I suggest two contradictory, or perhaps complementary, theories of the genesis of art. The first is that art originates in play, in improvisation, experiment, and fantasy. It remains forever in its deepest impulse, playful and spontaneous, an exercise of the imagination. And this sort of thing generates stories. I think storytelling is so basic an instinct in our human species. We love to tell stories. We love to be told stories. We love to make up and invent stories of our own lives and create autobiographical fictions about ourselves. So something about the whole enterprise of telling stories is very playful and very, very satisfying. Then the second theory, the artist is born damned and struggles through his or her life to achieve an ever-elusive redemption by way of art. In this sense, the artworks are not playful, and they're not, in a sense, even individual, but there's a sort of overall vision or trajectory of a complete career in which the individual works have some sort of structural relationship with one another. I guess one starts to feel that way as one gets older, and there's a sense of a retrospective view of one's own career. So I think these two theories maybe are complementary, and we begin in play, but then we become more serious, and we're trying to create or solidify or articulate a certain vision of life that seems to be uniquely our own. And I'm not sure what I mean by damned. That's not really a theological sense, but perhaps just a sense that one has to acquit oneself and one has to justify one's existence. I'm not sure about that, and maybe people really disagree with that. Certainly the Puritans and the whole puritanical impulse in human beings would suggest that reading, you know, that we work very hard in this world to attain a kind of redemptive quality in somebody's eyes. In the beginning, of course, there is only playfulness and there is only consciousness when we're children. And I have a little section here, I won't read all of it. It has to do with the wonderful children's books by Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass. And both of those books were very important in my life, and I'm sure in many other people's lives. The portraits of Alice are paradigmatic in the sense of the imaginative voyage. One slips beneath the threshold of consciousness and the ego barriers dissolved and the controls dissolved as when we fall asleep at night. Then maybe someone falls asleep right now in this room, you know. You sort of, your ego control has a sort of dreamy and delicious dissolving, and you slip down beneath the level of consciousness and things rise up to you, very, very powerful, sometimes very powerful images out of the unconscious that you haven't created but seem to be part of your being. Well, the Alice in Wonderland books are about this. In one, Alice falls down the rabbit hole and she goes way down into a world that mimics and mirrors the surface world, but it's different in many ways as well. And then in the other, Alice Through the Looking Glass, you remember, she gets up on a mantle and she crawls through the mirror and gets into the parlor that's the mirror image of the real parlor, but it's different in significant ways, slightly sinister ways. Then she goes out through the door, and then she's outside, and she has her experience. Some of the experiences that Alice has, as many children's stories, are quite frightening. But always before she's eaten, there's a lot about cannibalism and being eaten, and eating and being eaten, and the Lewis Carroll stories, and dissolving and dying and getting very large and very freakish, and horrible things happen. But always before they happen to her, she exerts her control or she escapes. Then at the end of both books, you remember, she wakes up. She wakes up, and so her ego comes back into control. These are stories that I think psychoanalysts have dealt with in great detail. Even so, they have not ruined the beauty of the stories. I found them fascinating as a very young girl, because, of course, I didn't know who Lewis Carroll was. I don't think we look at the spines of books when we're very little. We simply read and enter into that imaginative world. And when I was very little, I tried to write before I could write, and I would have squiggles across the page with Crayola. Do you know how nice Crayola smell? When you're little, these things are just so potent and powerful. I guess I thought that a great power of an adult sort resided in the fact of having a pen or a crayon and being able to write. There's something talismanic and very wonderful. I think there really is something about having your own handwriting and your own signature. Many poets write their poetry in hand because it's their own handwriting. But I covered all sorts of sheets of tablet paper with these squiggles that were not really legible. I hope my mother has thrown these things out. I'm so embarrassed if anybody ever comes to interview my parents, it happens once in a while, my mother, hauls out these old humiliating and mortifying things that I'd love to get hold of and take away somewhere. An old, very yellow, crumbling snapshots and embarrassing things out of the deep past, because I'm not exactly that young, but my mother still has these things. And I think she has old tablets and so forth. I did lots of drawings of chickens that looked like human beings, unless they were human beings that looked like chickens. It was my task on our farm to help feed the chickens, and if any of you had tasks like that, you know how it enters your psyche so deeply. If you draw human beings, they tend to look like chickens. The main thing I remember about my childhood is that chickens are always hungry and always sick. Their feathers are always sort of shredding. And in childhood, probably the most elaborate fantasizing that we have on record is that of the Bronte sisters and their brother, Branwell. These children, as you know, lost their mother. They were very, very young, and their mother died. And they were living alone with their father in Haworth, in a very isolated rural country parsonage in England. And the father was a very eccentric person. He was, in fact, an English clergyman, but he had rather been a soldier. I don't know what happened, why he turned out to be a clergyman. He liked to fire guns, and he had a certain melodramatic violence about him. He would shoot the guns out the back door of the parsonage. This, I think, kept the children in a certain state of excitement. They withdrew, the four of them, and they had very intense storytelling sessions where they'd be telling one another stories. And these are long, involved serial stories. Eventually, they wrote them down. They created two fantasy lands. Maybe some of you have seen these little books. They're on display in the British Museum and at the Bronte's house. But I saw some of them this summer. I'd seen them before, but I was looking at them again this summer. What's remarkable about them is that they're tiny books. They mimic adult books. It's the sort of thing that I was doing and that other children have probably done, but the Brontes did them in great earnestness. It's the minute italic handwriting. You can barely read it, and you wonder how anyone could do that. And put so much effort into it. It's very, very touching. Well, they created two famous fantasy lands. One is Gondal, G-O-N-D-A-L, and this was the invention of Emily and Anne, and the other was Angria, the invention of Charlotte and Branwell, these fantasy lands. And in time, these sagas became very, very lengthy. These were chronicles of imaginary lands that were not broken off in puberty, but they continued until the Bronte children were really young adults. Charlotte wrote her last Angrian story at the age of 23. That's really extraordinary to carry a fantasy. It's so very long. Let's say they began when they were perhaps 8, 9, 10 years old and carrying that fantasy. And Emily and Anne continued until they were even older. Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, one of the great novels in the English language, is a continuation, in a sense, emotionally and I think other ways, of the sagas of Gondal. That was published in 1847. She was 29 at the time, and she died only a year later. Has a transformation of private loneliness and isolation into enduring works of art ever been more triumphant, I wonder, than in the case of the Brontes? And I have here a little clipping from a newspaper that I got recently as a sort of postscript to this effort. As you know, Charlotte Bronte wrote Jane Eyre, and that too is one of the great novels in the English language. Wuthering Heights was not successful when it was published. When we read the early reviews of that novel, it's just shameful. It just makes you feel like crying that a great novel like Wuthering Heights could receive such nasty and uncomprehending reviews. It's just heartbreaking. And then Emily Bronte died when she was 29, so she never really had much of a sense of how great a writer she was. However, Charlotte Bronte with Jane Eyre met a much, much warmer reception. Her book was not necessarily thought to be by a woman. There was doubt, and people thought, well, maybe a man had written because it was so good. Some people, one reviewer was suspicious because there's a lot about curtains in one part of the novel, and this reviewer was a woman herself, and she said she doubted a man would know that much about curtains. But anyway, when Jane Eyre came out, it was a bestseller. It was really very warmly received, thank God. But Jane Eyre entered the English culture almost immediately, it's one of these great, really great works. However, here's how it was received at home. 3 months after it was published, Charlotte told her sisters that she would finally tell their father. All this had been done in secret from this man, this patriarch. So she went into his study with a copy of her novel and the reviews. Now, all the daughters in the audience, I'm sure there's a lot of us, you know, you sort of shiver with excitement. You're going in to show your father you've written one of the great novels in the English language. It's a bestseller. And mostly all the reviews are very happy. And the reviews that aren't, you haven't brought in. You've left them somewhere else. So she goes in and she says, "Papa, I've been writing a book." He says, "Have you, my dear?" He's reading his newspaper. And he went on reading. "But," says Charlotte, "Papa, I want you to look at it." "Oh, I can't be troubled to read manuscripts," he said. She says, "But it is printed." He says, "I hope you have not been involving yourself in any silly expense." And she says, "I think I shall gain some money by it." This is an understatement. It was a bestseller. And then she says, "May I read you some reviews?" So she did. And then she asked him if he would read the book. He said she might leave it and he would see. In his usual teasing way, Mr. Bronte delayed his pronouncement till the end of dinner. Then he said to the children, by the way, they're all in their 20s, "Children, Charlotte has been writing a book, and I think it is better than I expected." That was all Mr. Bronte had to say on the subject. That's all he had to say on the subject. So you brought in one of the great novels in the English language to show your father. It's your first novel. It's a bestseller. All the reviews are good. And all he says is, "It's a little bit better than I expected. I have a little section about John Updike, who I understand has been here in this series, and John is a friend of mine. I don't see him very often, but I consider him a wonderful, wonderful writer. And his autobiography, Self-Consciousness, I think is really a fine book. In fact, no one has written with more exhaustive and convincing detail of the genesis of being a writer. This is in some kind of contiguous relationship with the Brontes. John presents himself in Self-Consciousness as a somewhat lonely and isolated child, but he didn't have any siblings. His fantasy world was completely within himself. And he defines himself as an artist in terms of self-consciousness, how the self comes into consciousness in various points. The point of skin, he had psoriasis when he was a boy. He felt that that estranged him from other people and made him sufficiently different or freakish from other children. Speech and its impediments, he had a stutter, and again, that made him very conscious and self-conscious in ways that the rest of us don't have to be. And this also, I think, made his ear very keen for listening. And the idea of breath, he had asthma. It sounds like this is a walking hospital of symptoms. And when you meet John, he seems completely healthy. But this is how he defined himself in terms of these various maladies. And then the yearning for transcendence, which is a kind of a religious yearning and religious hunger that seems to me very justifiably part of the enterprise of being an artist, though it's inchoate, it's hard to explain it. Well, parts of the book are really very fine. One of the best chapters is called Getting the Words Out, in which stuttering is examined. And Updike locates his origins as a writer in relationship to something so primary as breath and breathing and the use of the breath. Language is visual, too. He, like a lot of us, was played with ABCs, alphabetical blocks, where the letters were raised, and you could see the A, and you could feel it. It wasn't just two-dimensional, and putting the blocks down and spelling out. I suppose children today in this technologically advanced world have their own, like the 2 years old, or one, they have their own little word processors, and they're, you know, probably doing miraculous things, but in the old days, to which John Updike and I belong, we played with these blocks, something very physical. They couldn't just disappear the way things can in a word processor. But the most compelling part of Updike's childhood was the presence of his mother, who had wanted to be a writer and worked very hard at writing. She would go in a room, she'd close the door, he'd hear her typing away, and he wasn't necessarily welcome in the room. He'd be outside listening to that typing. It's like a primal scene. Freud never knew about this kind of primal scene. Freud wrote about a kind of dull and familiar primal scene, but this is much more sophisticated, where you hear the mother typing, and it's just there's no father at all in this primal scene. Just a big, very virile typewriter. The sound of her typing gave the house a secret, questing life, unlike that of any of the other houses up and down Philadelphia Avenue in Shillington, Pennsylvania. The child, John, discovered to his amazement that in his mother's head existed a rival world which he could not enter.
You're listening to a talk by Joyce Carol Oates. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Oates is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. It's Joyce Carol Oates this time. Here she is again, speaking in Portland in 1989.
Another thing, too, which is not really related, I suppose, to the seriousness of my talk, but I know that John Updike was very charmed by, very mesmerized by the New Yorker magazine. A relative gave the family a subscription to the New Yorker magazine. They were a farm family. They live out in the country. His father was a school teacher, but he commuted some distance. And they were really kind of isolated, and Updike would think of himself as a kind of hillbilly. And anyway, the New Yorker came in this household that was very sophisticated and these very elegant drawings, and he wanted to do anything he could to get in that magazine. The first thing he tried was drawing cartoons. He imitated James Thurber. Then later on, as we all know, he wrote short stories, and his first story was published in the New Yorker by the time he was 21. But he aimed himself for that market in a way that's just extraordinary. I've never heard of anything quite like it. And when I was talking with him about this, I said, what if, John, what if instead of the New Yorker, your aunt had given you all a subscription to Field and Stream? Or a little later, say, Hustler magazine. What would have happened to one of our great American writers? I have a little section in here which I will skip over about influences and how in our childhood we read virtually anything. We read comic books or we see movies, and today it would be television. And all these things enter into our imaginative lives. Faulkner said, read. Read anything. Read the classics, read the Bible, read comic books, read trash, read anything, but just read. And I think that's very, very fine advice. Vision informs execution, but is not any substitute for it. Obviously, you have to have certain abstract ideas to be a writer. You have to have a vision of the world. But there's no substitute for just the idea of craftsmanship and the execution on the level of sentences, paragraphs, and pages. Because writing is a craft. It might be analogous to cabinet making, I think, or to something that has to have a certain structural integrity. People who are very understanding about music, let's say, tend to be impatient sometimes with writing. I've had young writers who want to be published immediately, and they don't understand that the analog would be with a musical instrument where you practice for hours and hours and hours, knowing that you're not going to go on a concert stage immediately, but you have to work at your craft. If you're an athlete, you have to train for months and months. A wonderful young boxer like Mike Tyson, who knocks out his opponents in the 30 seconds or 90 seconds, didn't just do that by climbing in the ring. When I met Mike Tyson, I said, do you think you're a natural boxer? He said, of course not. I'm not a natural boxer. If I were, I'd be perfect. He started training when he was 14 years old, and years go into this. So the same thing was true with writing. If you don't read, don't write, because the effort will be heartbreaking and futile. You have to read in order to write. And you have to read your contemporaries. Otherwise, you'd be doomed to anachronism of style and subject. Your characters won't even have the right names, perhaps. You may expend yourself in fighting old battles of style and subject matter that have been won long ago or abandoned. You might be trying to write a good, clean sentence with a subject, verb, and discover that you're doing the sort of thing that Hemingway did already and did it very well. It's sometimes very painful to see the plight of the gifted amateur, someone who has talent, real talent, but doesn't know how to develop the talent. You see that often in art, where there's a natural facility for art, but the person has been stubborn or naive and hasn't looked at the history of art. Consequently, the person just does something that's been done 1,000 or a million times already, or trying to paint water lilies in a very impressionistic way, or starry nights and swirls of paint. And I do have an acquaintance who's a painter in Princeton, and she's really, I think, quite talented, but oddly unaware of the history of art. So she'd been working for a year on the kind of large paintings that Jasper Johns had done in the 1950s. These very elegant, mathematical-looking large canvases with little lines. They're very beautiful, and hers are beautiful too. But they came like 30 years after Jasper Johns had done his. And it's, in a way, I said it was heartbreaking to see this effort, because we don't live forever. And to put a year of your life into doing something, working very hard, actually creating a solid work of art, but it's something that somebody else has already done and has made famous. This seems to be very odd, very futile. But that's what happens if you're not aware of the history of your craft and what your contemporaries are doing. You burn out your own talent. Literature is a culture, not a cottage activity. It's not a haphazard congeries of hobbies indulged in by isolated, self-absorbed geniuses, but a mysterious evolutionary process. We're all participating in the evolution of culture. We don't know why. We don't know why our species does this. It's one of the qualities of our species. It's a quality of all human effort. Scientists are all working together. There's a scientific community that is cooperative and works together. Someone who is isolated and off to the side turns into a crank if he or she persists long enough without recourse to the community, becomes increasingly cranky and then in some cases very bitter and reclusive, not understanding that there has to be a communal relationship. And I began with the writer as a child, and I'll move along to the writer in embryo who enters a world of society, the socializing process of school, where we become rewarded for being bright and industrious and being able to write, and also for being tractable, cooperative. The storytelling and fantasizing instinct shifts now to another plane, and now it becomes more systematic, and it becomes almost, I would say, profane, because it becomes competitive, and you're using your natural talents in some sort of competition with others, and there's a certain profanation of talent, I think. It's unfortunate, but this is part of growing up. We find ourselves in a field of peers who are in fact competitors, and we become miniature adults, which I think is happening at ever younger ages. I'm sure there are parents in Manhattan who are trying to enroll their infants, or maybe their embryos, and these very elite nursery schools, and then they get into a very elite private school, and then they come out of the end of the channel or the chute, and they go to Harvard, Princeton, or Yale, or someplace like that. But it starts at ever younger ages, which I think is really a tragedy, because, of course, as you know, I put so much emphasis on fantasy and play and daydreaming for no purpose except the delight in it. As soon as you start competing, then something else enters in. And I talk a little bit about Mary McCarthy, who had a disastrous early childhood. She lost her parents, who were wonderful, wonderful people, and she was brought up in a very unpleasant, bullying household. She, Mary McCarthy, could define herself only by way of school and by being very, very superior. And that was a habit and a predilection that she carried on throughout her whole life. It sort of marks her for a certain kind of acid-like, assiduous style, where she's satirical and the tone is always one of superiority. Then we know about Sylvia Plath's childhood, and she's illustrative of something that is really tragic, because as she reached the heights of her powers as a poet, almost at the very hour, she became suicidal. She did commit suicide. So it's this violent trajectory of this meteor-like rise to great poetry. She's only about 30 years old, and then the abrupt drop. She died. But this can be understood in terms of her childhood. She suffered all her life from a frenzied and insatiable desire to excel, to be better than other people, especially other women. She didn't feel a sense of sisterhood. She always was competing with other people. And this goes back to her childhood. She had a father, Otto Plath, who was very eccentric. He was not eccentric because he was a college professor. but maybe that didn't alleviate things. He was a semi-invalid who was so stubborn he wouldn't go to a doctor. He suspected he might have cancer, but he didn't want to know, so he got more and more ill. He virtually lived in his study, and he would appear and teach and come back home. He had his meals in his study, he slept in his study. He would agree to see his children, who are quite young, Sylvia and her brother Warren, for only 20 minutes each evening. So the children waited for Papa to come out of the study, or maybe they were let in the study. They had only 20 minutes to make an impression on this person. In fact, he had diabetes, and eventually his foot, then his leg, became gangrenous and had to be amputated. And that's part of the whole horror of the nightmare existence of this father. I think of it as a parody of a parent. But he was obviously no loving parent, but a very exacting critic and judge. And when the children were allowed to see him, they had only these few minutes. They would have to show off. They would recite, or they'd brag about their grades at school, or they'd read him some little thing that they had written, and she would recite poems. When you consider this parody of a parent-child relationship, what motive would there have been for Sylvia to do anything except by way of proving to this father that she was special, superior to all her classmates and to her brother? In time, of course, as some of you know, the eccentric Otto Plath is transfigured into the dead, yet eerily living and malevolently potent father deity of the late Plath poems. She's a great poet, but a very limited poet. She is a major poet, and yet she's a poet we don't feel came to a full maturity. She's had extraordinary influence, especially on women poets, because she broke through a barrier of taboo. She wrote about subjects that women had not written about. Women were not allowed to write about these things. They were really forbidden. They were conditioned not to write about things like envy and hatred and violence and loathing, self-loathing, things that everybody feels, but women just were not really allowed to write about. And she has a number of poems that are very powerful. And probably the most famous poem is called Daddy. And here are all the infantile rage that she had suppressed as a child comes out, and it's brilliantly accommodated in this nursery rhyme cadences. It's like a nightmare. Quote, "You do not do, you do not do any more, black shoe, in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or chew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time." And in the poem's final percussive stanza, quote, "There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, daddy, you bastard, I'm through." And this is preliminary to her committing suicide. I think it's just so powerful to see that poem and those late powerful poems in terms of the childhood experiences that obviously led into them. It's a subject that interests me very much. For whom do we write and for whom do we perform? If you were to meditate and why you did, I mean any of you, sort of generically speaking, why you did the things you do, what fuels your ambition, why are you driven, if you are driven, whom are you performing for? If you really thought about it, the answers might be surprising. The courtship of a remote, absent, or deceased parent is commonly at the heart of much literary activity. Sylvia Plath's friend, Anne Sexton, who followed her into self-inflicted death a few years after Plath, often alluded to her mother, who was a very cold and rejecting mother. There was nothing that Sexton seemed to be able to do to make her mother value her and love her. She was, in fact, wearing her mother's fur coat when she died. She committed suicide in a car running the motor in a closed garage, and she was wearing her mother's fur coat. Anne Sexton informs us in a seemingly incidental aside, quote, "A woman is her mother, that's the main thing," in the poem Housewife. I can say parenthetically that I don't necessarily agree with that. There are many feminists who do feel that that's right, but I can't really say that that's right. Maybe it's because my own mother is so very nice, and I don't feel any adversarial relationship with either one of my parents. Anais Nin attributed her motive for keeping a journal, in time an immense multi-volume journal, to her hope of winning back her father, who had left the family when Anais Nin was very young. We know now, as if we needed to be told, but there has been a recent sociological study, that children are profoundly disturbed when their parents divorce, and the younger the child, the more disturbing it is. So there are various strategies that the person tries unconsciously to win back the love. They perceive that the children often perceive that they are part of the problem and they are to blame. So they try to win back that absent father. And sometimes if the parent dies, the same sort of thing goes on, where the child is trying to court a dead parent. It's very, very, it's very poignant. I have a friend, a contemporary American woman writer, who is very successful, has in fact made millions of dollars, and she said thoughtfully one day in conversation that I would ask her, you know, for whom did she think she was writing? And she thought about it, she said she was probably writing for her father, who was living, but he never bothered reading her books. He read other books, but he didn't consider her books the kind of thing that was worthwhile to read. So she's made this elaborate career and fortune trying to court somebody who's not interested. Another friend, a Princeton colleague, remarked that he supposed he wrote for a former mentor of his, the critic R.P. Blackmer. Unfortunately, Blackmer died in 1965. Willa Cather imagined a supremely male audience, as if she had to prove herself to men, and she imagined herself as a writer in masculine terms. Like George Eliot, you know, George Eliot wrote a famous essay called Silly Novels by Lady Novelists. George Eliot and Willa Cather, even their names are somewhat masculine. She hoped to repudiate her gender as a means of establishing herself as superior to the majority of other women, including the best-selling lady novelists of the late 1890s. The animosity within a writer's family, the refusal of a son or, less frequently, a daughter to comply with parental wishes may be surprisingly a very powerful factor in the shaping of a writer's life. I could give a lot of examples where there's antipathy, not courtship, but antipathy. Probably the best example would be Ernest Hemingway, whose hatred for his mother was really extreme and verging, some biographers suggest, on the pathological. It's very chilling to read letters that Hemingway wrote to people, and he would talk about his mother in very, very negative terms. He blamed the mother for the father's suicide, and it may or may not have been justified. But one of the things that he wanted or needed to do as a man with certain effeminate qualities, I mean, all men have effeminate qualities, all women have masculine qualities, nothing wrong with that. But Hemingway wanted to make or remake himself as a supremely and totally masculine man, so repudiating the mother was part of that strategy. I think this was a correct decision for him in terms of the greatness of his art and the importance of his art in terms of literary history. Not only did he repudiate the feminine in himself, but he expatriated himself from his background and from Midwestern and middle-class America, and this helped to make him the writer he was. He's one of those who sought out adventure. He was actually quoted in an interview as saying, there's nothing like being in an airplane crash to help you with your writing, provided you survive. And he broke his back. He was in tremendous physical pain. He would have felt, though, that the physical suffering was worth it. Eugene O'Neill is another colossus of our literature whose intense hatred for his father and his bitterness toward his father's treatment of their mother fueled his plays, his greatest plays, A Long Day's Journey into Night, really ascends to the level almost of Greek tragedy. It's melodramatic, and it's not petty and domestic in its origins, but by way of his language and intensity of his feeling, really it transcends the material and becomes one of our great American works, and it is certainly a tragedy. Without that hatred of the father, which may have been very unreasonable and exaggerated, I doubt that Eugene O'Neill could have had such intensity of vision. Now, all this is very strange because we feel we would like to be normal human beings, and there's nothing wrong with being normal. We all want to be normal, but nobody wants to be average. That's the problem. Can you be a normal human being and not just wind up being an average human being? That's kind of a Zen koan. One of the most peculiar and surprising motives for writing that I came across is that of the English novelist Anita Bruckner, who is a very fine novelist. She tends to be a woman's novelist, but men admire her too. She acknowledged in an interview for a Paris review that she writes solely as a means of escape from, quote, the despair of living. Writing is a way not of triumphing over solitude, but of anesthetizing herself to it. Were she happy, by which she means married and with children. Now, married women, you know, giggle a little hearing that, I'm sure. But Anita Bruckner thinks that if she was married and had children, she wouldn't want any career. But women who are married and women who do have children do want careers. So it's a good question, I think, of kind of myopia and misjudgment here. But when I read this, I thought, what an admission in an age of feminist orthodoxy to say something like that in public. Where the art and craft of writing is for Anita Bruckner's many contemporaries an almost sacred task undertaken with very nearly religious solemnity, it has been for Anita Bruckner, by her own account, hardly more than an escape from loneliness. Accordingly, she doesn't trouble to ever revise her work. It's always the first draft, she says. And this therapeutic enterprise has given her, paradoxically, a good deal of acclaim and fame. Her books are even bestsellers, especially in England. And she does it all because she has to escape from the despair of her solitude. In one of her early novels, Look at Me, the writer protagonist says, it's clearly autobiographical, quote, when I feel swamped in my solitude, rendered invisible in fact, writing is my way of piping up, of reminding people I am here. And if I manage this well enough and beguile the critics, they will fail to register my real message, which is a simple one. If my looks and my manner were of greater assistance to me, I could deliver this message in person. Look at me, I would say. Look at me. Which doesn't explain why beautiful women like Virginia Woolf wanted to write. I'll skip along here and talk about youthful writers just at the beginnings of their careers. I'm sure there are many writers in the audience, and perhaps young writers and beginning writers. When you begin your career, you just don't have any notion of what will lie ahead. And you're so happy to have your first book published, there's just a tremulousness. It's so overwhelmingly exciting. You can't begin to comprehend how 25 or 30 years later you will wish that you could get hold of every copy of that first book and burn them. You're so embarrassed. This is particularly true of poets. I have a number of poet friends. For some reason, the first book of poems by a poet, these books tend to be very heterogeneous and sort of a miscellany put together, because a lot of years went into writing various poems and they get one book. After that, the books tend to be more organic and structured, but the first books by poets often tend to be almost like apprenticeship work, and they do want to get hold of them. But all youthful writers' ambitions are inextricable from the energies of adolescence, in which we feel audaciousness and hope and tremulousness. And you never pause to reflect at this point in your life that you are beginning the life of the career, and there's no going back. At the outset of my talk, I was suggesting that there is a kind of adversarial relationship between the career and the writer, and I meant that very seriously, that our private selves are one thing, and the careers, the images that people project upon us, are sometimes very, very misleading. The ceaseless challenge for the writer is the mediation between the centripetal tug of the inner life and the centrifugal tug of the outer world, the public world. We protest our dilemma, we must accept its vicissitudes as part of the fact of life of being a writer. As Henry James has said, quote, and I'm ending with this very eloquent remark, I think it's so wonderful. We work in the dark. We do what we can. We give what we have. Our doubt is our passion, and our passion is our task. The rest is the madness of art. Thank you.
That was the iconic novelist Joyce Carol Oates speaking in Portland in 1989. You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, and the Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online. You can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. Thanks for joining us.